You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
48 years ago today, President Lyndon Johnson signed the Voting Rights Act into law, marking a major victory in the civil rights movement. And the 50th anniversary of the March on Washington is later this month. To mark that occasion, the Library of America is publishing a two-volume anthology called Reporting Civil Rights, which revisits the first draft of history that reporters and writers created in books, magazines, and newspapers. With us now are two of its editors, Claiborne Carson, a history professor at Stanford University, and the director of the Martin Luther King Jr. Research and Education Institute, and Bill Kovach, former curator of the Nieman Foundation for Journalism at Harvard University, a journalist and editor for 40 years. I'm very pleased to welcome both of them to the show. I mispronounced your name after we talked about it. It's Kovach. Okay.
Good job.
Anyway, this collection has almost 20 newspaper and magazine articles, book excerpts, and features by 151 writers from 1941 through 1973. You must have had a huge team of researchers combing through the archives.
They very carefully dug through the archives in order to put this together. And by the time they had pulled together the mass of material, they asked the four of us to make other suggestions or to advise on the development of the collection.
Claiborne Carson, how could all of you have whittled it down to just 2,000 or so pages?
Well, I think that was hard. I was saddened when some of the choices that I had made did not get in, because I think that in some ways, if you put any group of people together, articles that might have influenced me might not have, some other people might not have been aware of them, particularly people who are writing for publications that didn't reach a large national audience.
Well, reading
and
them,
that was often the case.
Reading them in retrospect, did they take on added meanings? When we read them today, do we read them quite differently than we might have when they were written?
My own answer to that is that I think the major thing it does is it brings you back to those times. And as you mentioned, that notion of journalism being the first draft of history, sometimes the first drafts are rough. Sometimes they're a bit wrongheaded. They didn't get quite everything right. Things that we found out later were not clear to them then. But that's the joy of going back to these pieces, is that it's journalism as an act of discovery, of the experimentation of trying to find new forms to represent a new movement that's unfolding.
Bill Kovach, many of these pieces are reflections of what was happening, of people trying to make sense of ongoing events.
Yes, and I have to say, Leonard, the beauty of this collection to me, you know, I was born and grew up in Upper East Tennessee, where segregation was as normal and natural as breathing. And I covered a good part of the movement. I witnessed to a number of the major stories. And yet, when I read this collection, it opened my eyes to things I had not absorbed.
Now, as a journalist in the South, were there certain conventions that you were expected to follow when you were reporting stories like these?
Fortunately, I worked for a paper that the Nashville Tennessean that wanted to cover the movement on in full. So I was not necessarily limited by my publication. I was limited by the people I had to talk to. White people, many of them, most of them, the ones who mattered in this story, considered white journalists as traitors, Southern white journalists as traitors. So we couldn't make a story out of them.
The reason I ask is there are reminders of the lesser-known indignities of segregation Here, one piece is by Hodding Carter, who edited a paper in Greenville, Mississippi. He describes making the decision in 1951 that his paper would refer to African Americans with Mr. and Mrs. before their names. That kind of respect was not shown?
Absolutely not. And the interesting thing about Big Hod's piece is that no black man ever raised the issue with him. It was a black woman who raised it, and he had to decide, well, if I call her Mrs., I have to call him Mr.
She said, we've been married for a long time.
Exactly.
Please call us Mr. and Mrs. Carson, can you see a difference in the way the newspapers in the North and the South reported the civil rights movement?
Well, I think that when you look at it not just as a Southern movement, but as something that was happening throughout the nation, and I think that's the way I look at it, there was a sense the South was far away, and not very many newspapers had the resources to send a reporter or to have a bureau in Atlanta or even the larger cities in the South. So part of what was happening was that a lot of the early articles that appeared about the movement as it became more massive in the 1950s and 60s would appear in the Los Angeles Times, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the larger newspapers that had the resources to cover this unfolding story. And that's where the smaller press played such a major role.
Because a lot of the writers here are well known, but some of the more interesting stories are from people we never heard of.
Yes, and those are the reporters that Clay's talking about, the Chicago, Pittsburgh, the black newspapers, who had some of the great reporting. And again, that's part of what opened my eyes. Those reporters were on the same stories I was on, but they stayed in a different hotel. They ate elsewhere, and we didn't interchange. And I found out about their stories when I read these books.
Although you're talking about the South, some of these stories do refer to problems in the North as well.
Exactly. One of the things that happened is that as the movement became larger during the 1960s, new publications were created so that the story could get out. Each of the civil rights groups had their own magazines and newspapers, and then the underground press, as we called it at the time, and came into existence.
No, there's some. Go ahead.
So part of the reason why they did was that they were unsatisfied with the mainstream press, that they felt that the real story of the movement was not getting out. So you had newspapers like the Mississippi Free Press that were created to draw attention to what was going on in Mississippi, which got almost no attention in the mainstream press.
So the Times and the Washington Post were not really covering these stories?
No, I mean, most, in fact, I was just talking with Roger Mudd, and they were following Martin Luther King for the most part. So if Martin Luther King came someplace, but he didn't go to the Delta of Mississippi. So how would the story about the unfolding voting rights movement there get covered? That was an issue that led to the creation of a new... new periodicals, just an explosion of new periodicals during the 1960s.
There were a few of the Southern papers, like the Tennessean, the Chattanooga Times, that covered the stories pretty well down south. But as you're saying, Clay, John Herbers, whose work appears in this collection, was the UPI reporter in Mississippi, and he wrote some fine stories about what was going on, but the papers that carried AP would cut those parts out of his stories because, quote, they didn't want to embarrass the state government.
That's a really good point, and I should have made that that these were some of these reporters were heroic. I mean, we talk about the heroes of the activist movement, and they were certainly heroic, but for the reporters who really wanted to get close to the movement as it unfolded, that took risk. There were reporters who died. This was a, you know, they should have, I don't know whether they did, but they should have gotten combat pay sometimes.
Nope.
My guests are Claiborne Carson and Bill Kovach, two of the four editors of a 2,000-page, two-volume set from the Library of America called Reporting Civil Rights. And there are some pretty famous things here. There's classic writings from A. Philip Randolph's letter calling for a march on Washington, Martin Luther King Jr.'s 1963 letter from Birmingham jail, Robert Penn Warren's Segregation is Included in Its Entirety. These are documents, of course, that have to be preserved. But we also have writing.
James Baldwin,
I was going to say James Baldwin, John Steinbeck, David Halberstam, Joan Didion, Renata Adler, Alice Walker, Gordon Parks, Jimmy Breslin, to name just a few.
That's a pretty good list of writers.
Yeah, and these are writers who are talking more than just about what's happening in the news, but also what they see as the major shifts in the culture.
And that was the key story, and the one that was hardest to tell, especially for Southern reporters, because we never really became aware of it until Brown versus Board of Education. Before that ruling, the coverage of racial issues, racial habits, racial practices in the South, the general press, even the best press, were in effect either affiliated with a government in one way or the other, or enablers of the system that was in place.
You include an excerpt from John Howard Griffin's Black Like Me. Mr. Griffin was a white man who underwent treatment to darken his skin and then attempted to pass as an African-American to report on segregation. Was that attempt unique?
Clay?
Oh, certainly that was unique. I don't think anyone would have gone to that length to tell a story. And
that was a bestseller because people were stunned by what the story he told.
There was an earlier case of Walter White.
Walter White.
Who was a very light-skinned black man who covered racial stories in the 1920s, including lynchings, you know, where he could have been the person being lynched. So I think that notion of going to great lengths to get close to this unfolding story and taking risk, you know, that's something that goes back a ways.
You mentioned reporters who were not part of the mainstream press. Are there parts of the civil rights movement that have been largely forgotten that you feel are rediscovered in this collection?
I think so, in terms of reminding us that even the term the civil rights movement is somewhat of a misnomer. I would call it, America's racial dilemma unfolds, you know, which maybe that's the reason why we like a shorter term like civil rights movement, because this was something that it didn't start in 1954 and it didn't end in 1965 or 1968. This is a story that's still with us. It's a King after Birmingham and after the Voting Rights Act went to Chicago, and he ended up in Memphis working in the Poor People's Campaign.
He went to Chicago because Mahalia Jackson, among others, asked him to come up there and talk about segregation in the North.
Well, not just talk about, but lead a movement. And you know, the movement
which
was
kind
in
of
Chicago.
Failed.
It was in Oakland and San Francisco and New York and places like Cambridge, Maryland, which didn't get a lot of play. Mm-hmm. I think that one of the secrets that is kind of unlocked here is that you begin to see this as an unfolding national story. And it's something that was focused in the South because there was this peculiar institution, of the Jim Crow system. And that the overcoming of that Jim Crow system is one of the great freedom stories of human history. You know, that's something that I think people will be writing about 500 years from now, because it's not often that a major system of oppression gets overthrown, just like slavery. But that job was pretty well accomplished by 1965. But we're still dealing with the racial issue. We're still dealing with, and once we found out that the South really wasn't that different from the North, once you got past the Jim Crow system, that was a revelation. It wasn't a revelation to these journalists who covered it on both sides of the Mason-Dixon line. But it was, I think it still is, a revelation to many Americans who think that, you know, I see these references back to the civil rights days. Well, I was in the movement, and I didn't know exactly when that ended.
Well, according to this two-volume set, it ended in 1973, but we'll get back to that in just a moment. I'm speaking with Claiborne Carson and Bill Kovach, who, along with David J. Garrow and Carol Polsgrove, make up the editorial board for a two-volume box set, 1,982 pages, called Reporting Civil Rights. It is published by the Library of America. We will continue our conversation after this. We are back with Bill Kovach and Claiborne Carson, who, along with David J. Garrow and Carol Polsgrove, make up the editorial board for a two-volume box set called Reporting Civil Rights, the Library of America edition. And Bill, you said earlier that working on this collection opened your eyes to things that you hadn't seen or realized when you were covering it at the time. What did you learn or realize from working on this project?
Basically, what I learned was that only when the leadership of what became the civil rights movement figured out a way to focus on one thing, was it possible to engage the American press in a way that sustained a story day after day after day.
That's because the press relies on narrative rather than just telling us what went on. Sometimes that leads to a real distortion.
Yes, that's often the case. And they chose, and I think Clay describe this better than I can, but they chose not to focus on the economic issue, which was the one that was punishing most black people. But they chose,
which Martin Luther King did talk about a lot.
But A. Philip Randolph's call to come march on Washington was a call to come about jobs, and it never occurred. So it broke down because it didn't focus in a way that would capture the attention of the broader press and public.
You want to add to that, Clay?
Well, I would certainly agree with that. I think that I was at the March on Washington, but after that, I went to live and to go to school at UCLA, I was in Los Angeles for most of the next 10 years. And there was a strong movement there, and I was involved with groups that were primarily concerned with issues of jobs, housing, and those sorts of things. You didn't have the problem of restaurants. Well, I guess maybe there were a few, but it was primarily those kinds of issues. And I think that after 1965, what we found out is that those issues were national. Those issues were deep-rooted. There were far fewer reporters who wanted to get into that, primarily because it wasn't the kind of heroic story of demonstrators trying to overcome an oppressive Jim Crow system.
Now, James, you quote, you have James Baldwin's letter from Harlem from 1960, in which he wrote about white Northerners. He said, they seem to feel that because they fought on the right side during the Civil War and won, they've earned the right merely to deplore what's going on in the South without taking any responsibility for it, and that they can ignore what's happening in northern cities because what's happening in Little Rock or Birmingham is worse.
Yeah, and when it did come north, it was this huge shock, you know, that King, I think he, even King was very
yes.
surprised when the reception he got in Cicero and where rocks were thrown at him and people with Nazi signs and just the real ugliness of what happened in Boston in the school desegregation dispute, what happened in New York with the issue of local control of schools. You know, all of these issues, when that, you know, it was one thing to kind of point your finger at the Bull Connors of the world. And certainly they were in a distinctive category. They played, as Martin Luther King said, they played their role to the hilt. And that's why the Jim Crow system was overcome, was because they did, the fire hoses and the police dogs were so outrageous that the nation rejected that. But the much more subtle kind of segregation and discrimination that occurred in the North, you know, what we, you know, I guess Michelle Alexander has kind of placed the label the new Jim Crow. You know, there was a new Jim Crow that came into existence in the late 60s and 70s, and journalists have had a very difficult time writing the first draft of that history because it's too close. It is too subtle to, you know, it's much easier to write about police dogs and fire hoses and racists like Bull Connor than what was going on with Bill Daley and just what was going on in the North.
Well, right here in New York City, where, which is an integrated city, there are large pockets of large areas which are all black, where you don't see a white person for 20 or 30 blocks on end. So we have segregation here, maybe to some degree it's simply because of what happened historically or in by choice in some cases, but it's there.
That's true with virtually everything we go about, and we're talking about now reporting an issue, reporting civil rights. And what reporters do is they report what's new. And the magic, the brilliance of what Martin Luther King was able to do was he was able to take a practice that had occurred 24 hours a day, 365 days a year for two centuries, and make a new story out of it by focusing on a new aspect of the story.
Well, has the retelling of the movement changed over the last 40 years? When we read the various books about what happened, are we reading something a little different from what we learn when we look at the documents of the time?
You're not reading it in the daily paper. That's the difference. The books are based on broader research, but the daily story that makes a thing a movement needs a focus, and that's what's missing now on the issue that Clay's talking about.
My guests are Bill Kovach and Claiborne Carson, who, along with David J. Garrow and Carol Polsgrove, made up the editorial board for a two-volume box set from the Library of America called Reporting Civil Rights. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Clay, the first volume covers writings from 1941 to the March on Washington in 1963. The second goes from 63 to 73. Was 1963 a turning point for the struggle for equality, or was it simply that it was a good place to collect 1,000 pages by and then start up another 1,000 pages for the next 10 years?
I think that the, well, to some degree it was kind of arbitrary. You know, you get enough to fill one volume and then you start another volume. But I think that 63 is a good pivot in terms of the kind of stories that you want to tell. I think that the by 1963, with the March on Washington, the movement reached a point of visibility, national visibility, and it kind of entered its stage of, you know, for the next 10 years, that story was the major national story. You know, what is happening in terms of not just civil rights, but race relations in the United States. It was the big domestic story. And it had many aspects. You know, Watts was part of that story. You know, all of these sorts of things. And I think that that's where the journalism, you know, to me, provided a first draft that is still very useful to us, because that was the era of big events. You know, the assassination of Malcolm X and Martin Luther King and you know, the riots and you know, all of these big stories. I think what has happened over time, though, is we've become more aware of two aspects of that big story. One of them is the top-down story, which kind of starts with Martin Luther King, and perhaps you might add in Malcolm X, but mainly Martin Luther King, and you kind of see him as the symbolic figure. And so there's a lot of focus on that. But then there was this bottom-up story, which I think that's where historians have kind of built on the journalistic story. I think going into what was happening at the grassroots level throughout the United States. There's been an outpouring of books on that, and it tells a quite different story.
Well, you grouped Malcolm X with Martin Luther King, but obviously there was a constant debate between them. Malcolm was a strong advocate for separation of the races until he broke with Elijah Muhammad. Their dispute was often written about in the press, perhaps because it made people happy to hear that there was a dispute within the civil rights movement.
I don't think Malcolm X was in the civil rights movement. I mean, that's not his. It was only very late in his life that he, you know, came to Selma and supported passage of, you know, the end of voting rights discrimination.
But he was an influential voice at the time.
Oh, of course. But again, you know, in terms of the bottom-up story, Malcolm X represented an upsurge of grassroots militancy that culminated in the Black Power story, which came after Malcolm X. You know, people like Stokely Carmichael and H. Rapp Brown and the Black Panther Party and, you know, all of that. I think there again, that term civil rights movement, it doesn't really encompass. But I think it's the familiar term we use, because even today, we kind of refer to civil rights leaders and see things in terms of civil rights, when in fact, it's not just you know, the basic civil rights gains were made during the 1960s, and we really haven't gone too much past that. We've spent a lot of time defending it, and this gets to what's happened with the Voting Rights Act, but we haven't really made any significant voting rights, civil rights advances, but the race issues have stayed with us.
Now,
it's basically an economic issue.
Not long ago, we had Isabel Wilkerson here to talk about her wonderful book called The Warmth of Other Suns. Is the story of the Great Migration interwoven with the story of the Civil Rights Movement? How significant is that, Bill?
Oh, I think it's very significant. The migration of the black population to the North and bringing with them the energy and new ways of thinking with them. But again, like the second volume of this collection, we're moving into the dispersal of the focus of the story. It's now economic, it's now about schools, it's now about where you live, it's about all these issues. And in each time I covered the school decentralization story for the New York Times in New York, and that was now Jewish school teachers who were afraid of losing jobs. So the what used to be a focused civil rights story about disenfranchisement and punishment of blacks is now a story of competition for resources.
And also a story of changes in alliances, because
change every day on every issue.
Because Jews were often seen as allies of African Americans in the Civil Rights Movement, and then now suddenly we have a disagreement and a lot of anger in both
sides.
That
was the lead on my first story.
Now, Clay, you mentioned that the Supreme Court had this decision earlier this summer on the Voting Rights Act. So does that mean that we're still living with the legacy of the Civil Rights Movement?
Oh, of course, just like we're living with the legacy of slavery. It's the past doesn't go away. It's still very much with us.
As William Faulkner pointed out once.
Yeah, and we might have that disease of, that many Americans have, of historical amnesia, but just because you have the disease, it doesn't mean that the past has gone away. It's with us, and the way in which many of our problems are connected with race is something that we ignore at our peril. You know, we kind of want to assume that, and this is part of the Supreme Court decision, that the conditions that made necessary the Voting Rights Act, today's conditions are so different that we don't need those same protections today. And I guess my response to that is we'll see. We'll see in terms of how things unfold. One of the ways in which I think I just kind of summarize where we are as a nation is that since 1964, there has not been a single presidential election in which a majority of white people and a majority of black people voted for the same presidential candidate. That's a continuing reality that will probably be around for many decades to come.
And Bill, we are out of time, really, but the collection ends in 1973. That's 40 years ago. Is another collection in the works to cover the last 40 years?
I hope it is. I've suggested it a couple of times, and I think they need a third edition. And I think the third edition might look forward to the new patterns of immigration that may eventually change the political outcome of these elections.
My thanks to both of you for being on our show, Bill Kovich and Claiborne Carson, who, along with David J. Garrow and Carol Pulsgrove, have edited a two-volume box set for the Library of America called Reporting Civil Rights. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thank you.